dedicated to HBO's Game of Thrones and George R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire book series. You're listening to Podcast Winterfell.
Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. We are a part of the DVR Podcast Network. Check us out at dvrpodcast.com. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. We're picking up a lot of new subscribers. We're doing a lot of podcasts. My name is Mike. I am a part of the Book Reader Deep Dive, and tonight I'm here with Tracy. How you doing, Tracy?
I'm doing great.
Want to give a special thanks to our new patrons, Bill, Kava, Cindy, James, and Justin. You're the best. So now we're talking about Season 7, Episode 4. What is it called? Axel sent us this thing. I should know that.
Spoils of War.
I thought we were going to have a duet. You dropped out of our duet. This episode was written by Dan and Dave, directed by Matt Shackman, who has directed all kinds of cool, weird, interesting things before this. If you don't know about him, you should look him up. So it's just us tonight. We don't have Donald because he didn't like the episode, and so clearly he's lost his mind. We had him committed. What did you think, briefly, Tracy? How did you feel about this episode? Did you watch it like 8 times? Did it give you goosebumps on the 8th watch?
I watched it 3 times, and I enjoyed it 3 times. I thought it was a great episode. Of course, there are highs and lows with everything, but I think it was a net positive. I mean, overall, it was just a fun and exciting hour of TV. Well, it wasn't an hour. 50 minutes or so of TV.
We missed every minute that wasn't that hour. But God, it was good, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, those last few minutes, I was just like staring at the television. No, not worrying about a phone, Twitter, nothing. Just watching the show. And I miss that, and I love it.
I mean, that's the like definition of real meditation, right? Is when it becomes timeless. Right. So, I mean, is there like a version of entertaining meditation? I don't know what that's called. I get that with books, though, sometimes where you're like, oh, my God, it's, you know, whatever. It's been 2 hours. How did that happen? And this was, you know, there was nothing happening on Earth but that damn dragon. Right.
Yeah. So what was you watched with your wife, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What was the
feeling?
I mean, okay, so. There's this movie Okja, O-K-J-A. It's a Netflix original.
Steven Yeun is in that, right?
Oh, my God. That movie is so good. That movie is so good. So if you can, of course you can. It's on Netflix. You can watch it. It's Okja, O-K-J-A, and it's a Netflix original. It's a fantastic film. So they did screenings, you know, in New York and L.A., right? Because they have to do that for Academy Award consideration. So we went to go see Okja in the theater. I was super excited about it. And it's an amazing movie where this corporation invents a new kind of animal, and then they take the greatest example of this animal, and they are going to show it off to the world, right? But this little girl loves it, and so it ends up like I don't want to get into it, but there's some, the animal is injured in a couple of ways, right? Now, my wife walked out of the theater because this animal that doesn't exist, this is like a pure, it's like, it might as well be a dragon, right? Was being injured in this movie and she couldn't take it and she walked out. Okay, now point number two about my wife. She can tell you scene by scene everything that happens in the Final Destination movies, right? You can murder a million people on television and it won't hurt, but she won't watch the John Wick movies because a dog gets hurt in the movie, right? This is just how she is. And I love her for it. She's a better person than I am. She has compassion for everything, the spiders and all, right? We're watching this thing, and when Drogon gets hit with the arrow, she almost as if she was hit herself. You know, just like making noises and like squirming around on the couch, you know, like was just really feeling it. And I mean, that's pretty incredible. You know, this thing doesn't exist. There's never been a dragon, right? Like, let's just take a minute to say that out loud, you know. But there has been so much of Dany invested in these things, you know, and we see the scene where Tyrion lets them free and you know, they are flying death machines, like they're cooking people in their armor, right? But there's been so much invested in them that when they get hit by an arrow, you know, we all feel it. Like, that's pretty incredible. You know, and that was one thing that let, you know, one of the reasons why Donald has been banished this week. That's not really true. He's just working, so he couldn't join us. But one of the things that he got a lot of hell for on Twitter was he said that nothing in this episode was earned, you know. And when I had, like, feelings about this dragon getting hit by an arrow, that's, come on, man. Like, I don't know what else you call that.
We've seen the dragon grow from the size of a cat to what it is now. I mean, if that's not, you know, a long-term relationship, man, I don't know what is.
That's exactly right. I was, you know, I just was blown away. And, you know, I mean, I love Bronn, and it just, anyway, there was a lot to it. So we can get into some details. I've done a terrible job of sticking to a schedule, a platform, a way of working through the episode. So I'm going to hand it over to you tonight. Why don't you walk us through this thing?
Okay, so we're going to split it up by location again since the episode jumped around a ton. And I figure it'll be easier to start with the areas that are a little more isolated. So we can just go to King's Landing, at where Cersei is meeting with the Iron Banker, Tycho. You know, in this scene, he was really heaping on the praise towards Cersei and, you know, oh, I'm so impressed and I thought your father was good, but wow.
And it's high really, praise.
Yeah. And, you know, looking forward to working with her in the future. And it's hard to see him as someone other than who he says he is. But I did start to wonder this episode because there was so much praise. And I'm like, is he buttering her? Like, does he have an ulterior motive here or what?
Doth protest too much. I mean, that, yeah, I think that's like, I don't know, though. He's playing it well. It may just be how he thinks women want you to talk to him. What do you think? I mean, do you think he's got an ulterior motive? What do you think it is?
You know, I really don't know. And it's odd to hear him say, you know, I need the gold, I need the gold, I need the gold. Okay, so do you need us to lend you any more money for anything? You know, the juxtaposition right. of it was odd to me. And then he's being so, so, so nice to her that I was just kind of like, But again, what else could there be? What else could he want? I mean, other than money. I mean, I think the big key also in that conversation was the name drop of the Golden Company.
Mm-hmm.
And
Let's talk about that because, you know, this is the Book Reader podcast, right? So we get into the book stuff. We are of the opinion that there's not really any spoilers left. So let's talk a little bit about the Golden Company, like what it is in the book and how you think they would introduce it in the show.
I mean, I really didn't even think they would come up. So I'm a little bit surprised. And I'm wondering if so. I mean, as far as I remember in the book, they were a sellsword company that was pretty much made up of the sort of bastards and forgotten sons of Westeros going through Essos, making their money fighting.
They're kind of like the Night's Watch, only like dirty mercenaries for money. But similar to that, you know, to the way the Night's Watch is sometimes made up of men with names, you know, the Golden Company is similarly positioned.
And the person who founded it, I'm trying to remember his story. See, I started to look this up and I got distracted.
So, we'll take a moment and I'll just talk for a second. Do you want to look it up or no?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Tower of the Hand. They're pretty fast.
Well, you know, they're basically another one of the mercenary companies. And the only mercenary company we've really gotten to know so far is the Second Sons. Well, I guess in the Unsullied, we're kind of a mercenary company, too, who don't really think of themselves that way anymore. But the Second Sons were a mercenary army, and they're an army for sale, you know. So then Dario kills the other two heads of the company so they can he can kind of take over and dedicate them to Danny. But they remain basically a company for sale. And so that is one of the questions that's been floating around about this episode is the possibility that Cersei will end up hiring the Second Sons, which I'm not totally sure how that would even work since they are remain as they've basically taken over Meereen or are running Meereen. So I guess that would kind of lead Dario to have a moment where he had to make some sort of a decision or whatever. That doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. It makes a lot more sense to me that they would just introduce the Golden Company who don't already have a horse in this race.
Right. Now, if you remember, I kind of was wondering if Varys was going to have ulterior motives because of his whole Blackfyre rumblings from the book.
Right.
That's kind of tied into the Golden Company, right? And like how the people who were left behind, like they have all the bastard last names.
Right.
You know, that sort of made me feel like, okay, maybe they can pull that storyline in at the last minute if they do it through the Golden Company hired by Cersei.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they could.
Their words were, our word is good as gold and beneath the gold, the bitter steel. I remember I needed that for book reader trivia. In New York City. And that came in clutch because it was at the very end. And knowing those words like saved our butt. That gave us a third place finish for book reader trivia. So that was some intense competition.
Bouncing up and down. I know it.
It was Aegor Rivers who founded the Golden Company. Bastard son of Aegon Targaryen and Barba Bracken. So that is who started it.
So they have a pedigree.
Yes, the son of a Targaryen.
Right. So, I mean, do you think that's what she's going to do? Do you think that's, would that be smart? Would it, I wonder, what does the Iron Bank get out of that? Do they own a piece of the Golden Company?
Well, I guess they get interest, right? I mean, you know, that's
she would borrow the money from them to pay the Golden Company, so they would get the interest regardless.
And she might be feeling kind of desperate now after, once she hears word of what happened.
I would say so.
You know, so she might feel like that that major purchase that she was thinking about might be worth an investment.
Do you think the Iron Bank is in any way in league with Dany? Because, you know, I think that her point basically about, you know, she seems more interested in being a revolutionary than a monarch. How do bankers fare with revolutionaries? I thought that was a really solid point on Cersei's part. Pretty hard to argue. Is there any indication that the Iron Bank would be mixed up with Dany? There's really not, right?
No. I mean, has she had a chance to even deal with that? I mean, I almost feel like she would be offended or, you know, like kind of feel morally superior to that and want to get her riches through conquest on her own and not through a bank.
Right. All right. Very good. Well, let's see if we see the Golden Company. It seems like the easiest answer, which is what makes me suspect about it.
Okay, and I think that's pretty much it for King's Landing. So I'm kind of happy to move on to Winterfell.
Let's do it.
So lots happening at Winterfell. The first thing that we see is Littlefinger giving Bran that dragonglass dagger. And let me tell you, my brain was just
Valyrian steel. I don't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
But what did I say? Dragonglass?
Yeah, we're going to, get a bunch of comments. Let's just, it's Valyrian steel. Carry on. Sorry to interrupt.
Cat's Paw Blade. No, no, no. let me tell you, because I would have jumped right into. So my brain's sitting here like, why is he even talking to Bran? What are you doing? Are you like that, the murderer that goes back to the scene of the crime, like while the cops are investigating the scene? And like,
dude,
what are you doing? Like, why are you involving yourself? I mean, obviously he doesn't know what Bran is capable of. So, I mean, I won't fault him for that, but.
We're assuming Sansa's kind of keeping that in the family for now, right?
Yeah, I don't think they had a conversation about how her brother's totally weird now.
Right. Dude, Littlefinger's got brass ones, and they clang when he walks. I mean, he's completely, soulless, I guess, or I don't know. Like, it was pretty incredible to see that. And you know, Bran, this is, I don't know. I continue to be fascinated with Bran this season. And as kind of painful as it was to watch his reaction to Meera, you know, and the way he talked to Meera, I enjoyed the way he, you know, the same kind of effect with Littlefinger as much or more as it bothered me with Meera. You know, it was just it's so weird to see him kind of, because nobody else does that. And that's the thing with Littlefinger, is he's seems to be, you know, good at reading people. At least that's the way people talk about him. He didn't seem to be that good at reading John in the crypt, right? But he managed to get under Sansa's skin, it looked like, you know. And how do you read Bran? Right? There's nothing to read.
And there's no weakness there either, right? Because you figure Littlefinger probably tries to figure out what, you know, people's weak points are based on what they care about, what they love, and then he knows how to exploit you. But with Bran, you've got nothing. You know, there's nothing to read. There's no leverage. He doesn't need you for anything. You know, there's nowhere for someone like Littlefinger to go. So trying to ingratiate himself with Bran for whatever reason is a complete failure.
And he hands over the dagger. Okay, so do we know how he got the dagger back? And I just don't remember. Like, what's the status with that? Because I was kind of surprised to see it.
The last time I remember seeing it was just when he was talking about it with Catelyn. I don't remember seeing it again. But that could be my memory.
Oh, he tried to give it to Kat, right? And she told, I don't know. Or she gave it back to him? Anyway. Whatever. It was a weird choice. It was a very weird choice. I don't understand why he would do that.
I mean, and I guess it could just be a plot device to get it in Bran's hand. So he says, do you know who used to own this?
Mm-hmm.
Because that must be something notable or some person.
Okay, then Bran hit him with the chaos as a ladder.
Yeah.
What's up with that? Is that a goosebump moment for you? I mean, because, you know, because it's one of those things that I don't think everybody, I mean, I know for a fact, not everybody picked up that callback, you know, on the initial speaking of the line there. Did that hit you right off the bat, or was that something you kind of picked up later?
It hit me right away because I'm one of the few people that actually liked that speech.
Right.
I loved it, and I feel like that was a great scene because Littlefinger is telling you what he's all about, and there's no prostitutes diddling each other in the background, right? It's just him speaking his truth. And I mean, he says, like, chaos isn't I like it because he says it's not a pit, it's a ladder, right? It's not just chaos is a ladder, right? It's not a pit, meaning other people see it as a pit. Other people can't adapt. Mm-hmm. They can't adjust when everything around them is going crazy. He sees opportunity, and he'll take it every time. That's how
what
I get
a
it.
Scumbag.
You know?
I mean, God. Oh, he's so crazy. God. He's really good. I mean, you know, that's one of those things about an actor, right? Is like when you just can't stand them, you know they are killing it. You know they're doing so good. And he is driving me nuts. I complain about him and like the way he says the same, you know, listening last week, I was complaining about the actor, but I'm back and forth on it, man. You know, because I'm in there with him and that's good, right? Isn't that the mark? I mean,
accent aside, I think he's doing fine. I mean, he's the right level of creep. You know, he's not too handsome. He's not too anything. You know what I mean? Like, he's just on the fringes, you know, always on the margin. You never feel like you could trust him. Yeah, like, I think he's doing a great job. I mean, I thought I hated Carcetti. And now, like, I feel if I go back and watch The Wire, I'm going to say, like, it's not so bad.
Yeah. So, okay. So, the knife that tried to kill Bran, he said he lost in a bet to Tyrion Lannister.
Uh-huh.
Now, why? Okay. Do you believe that? Do you think he actually was trying to kill Bran for some reason? And do you think that he is going to, for some reason, try to kill Bran now? I mean, the whole thing is confusing.
I mean, why would, so if we go back to season one, Littlefinger is master of coin in King's Landing, just orchestrated the death of Jon Arryn. He knows Robert is asking Ned to be the Hand. Kill his kid
for what?
You know, I don't know.
Right?
Like, wouldn't he still? Should be riding high on his success, right? I mean,
also, like, you'd think he's got more important things to concentrate on. You know, at that moment, like that. What a weird distraction that Littlefinger's thinking about Bran, right?
Yeah, I mean, somebody rich wanted to kill me. I thought for a moment, could it have been Littlefinger, but it just feels too easy.
Then what's he doing now? Maybe, I mean, is it also the simplest possibility that we're completely overlooking here, which is that in some way he thinks it's a nice thing to give him. In some way he, like, it's legitimate. Like, we're trying to find some underhanded thing he's doing, but he does kind of recognize that his best shot right now is just to stick with the Starks, you know, or whatever, right? Now, I personally really like the idea that him and Varys are both, if not working with Cersei, going to try to run back to her. But is there evidence for that? I don't know. Maybe we're just like trying to, you know, build a sandcastle with, you know, when the tide's coming in. You know what I mean? Like, maybe we're just like, we're doing too much work. We're heavy lifting here and we really shouldn't be. Right? It's possible.
I know, and it's certainly possible that they haven't revealed enough information for us to even come to the correct conclusion about who this wealthy person is, why Littlefinger ends up with the knife anyway. Like, let it unfold.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to skip a bunch of stuff and ask you, we see later at Winterfell, Littlefinger sees that Arya has the knife, right? We can go back and talk about the other shit if you want, but I'm really kind of obsessed with this knife right now. He sees that Arya has the knife. What do you think? How do you think he feels about that? I mean, that was a weird. I felt like him and Sansa both, their reactions to that scene were very odd. But,
yeah,
you know, Littlefinger's.
Unsettled.
Right. But Littlefinger was, you know, kept his poker face on a little bit better. It makes sense because what the hell is Bran going to do with it? But. That I'm sure that's not what how little he it doesn't seem like a thing he would be thinking about in terms of efficiency, right?
Yeah, I mean, so he gives this to Bran. Arya shows up on the scene. Now she has it. I mean, well, look, they're siblings. Like, why would he couldn't be troubled by it, right? I mean, what did you want to happen? Did you want Bran to become a fighter now? Like, should he just stare at it? Should he have it framed or, you know, put up on the wall maybe?
Could gather dust on the mantle.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that relationship is probably going to be really interesting going forward. Littlefinger Arya. because she is suspicious, like Sansa and Brienne, but she's impulsive enough to do something about it.
Yeah. This is what, you know, this is part of why I felt like this episode was really pretty great, on because I've watched it three times also, I'm pretty sure, some maybe more. But there were a lot of these, like, big, obvious, you know, the dragon blew things up, the gold made it to the gate, you know, right? Brienne and Arya, like, there's all these kind of, like, big, obvious things. But at the same time, like, we've been talking about Littlefinger for 15 minutes and have come to no conclusions. There were, like, there were also a lot of just little interesting things piled up inside of here. You know, Arya has a Valyrian steel blade now. Is Arya going to be the one, you know, like, is she going to be put into service at the wall? I mean, for Christ's sakes, that's insane. Like, Matt has been waiting for Arya to, like, go back to, like, happy river dancing Arya for, like, seven seasons now. And apparently she's going to murder White Walkers. Like, he's going to, you know, his head's going to explode, right? Like, I don't know. I thought this episode was really great because for that reason. There were lots of big obvious things and lots of little tiny things that have just kept me guessing ever since. So Arya shows up. She's got a great scene at the entrance and you know, some callbacks to season one again.
Uh-huh.
You know, she outsmarts those guys rather than murdering them, which I thought it was nice of her.
Everybody exhales a sigh of relief, like, oh, you guys don't even know.
You guys have no idea how close you got to that snake pit. And then we have a scene with Sansa and Arya together, and I thought it was very well played. You know, they didn't fall down to their knees and cry and sob and become completely different people. You know, they kind of showed their pain to each other a little bit, and also respected each other's pain, I thought.
Uh-huh.
Which was really interesting. I was fascinated to see everybody think Sansa's worried that she's on Arya's list. Which, I don't think she is. And then they had a scene with Bran at the Weirwood tree, which, you know, again, I mean, I think all of this is really playing out very well because we've been waiting for all these people to come back together, and none of it's going to be easy. You know, I do suspect, though, that when we finally see Jon and Arya together, that we're going to get that just like smooth like butter. They're just going to hug and cry, and we're just going to get to have that fan moment, you know.
That might be the moment where I cry at Game of Thrones. I have yet to shed a tear at anything on Game of Thrones, but that might do it. When A Search of Ice and Fire came out, the first thing I searched was Little Sister,
right?
Because I knew I would get them remembering each other.
Yep.
So I might not be able to handle that.
No judgment here. No judgment here.
I love how Arya and Sansa just fell right back in step. You know, they're completely changed, but they're still sisters, you know? And, like, I don't have sisters that are close to me, and actually all my siblings are much older than me, so I never really had that. But I do know that when you don't see them for a while, how quickly you fall right back into your old patterns. And you have the same arguments, and you pick on the same things, and it doesn't matter that somebody has kids now and someone's married now. It doesn't matter.
Yep. You do the same thing with friends, you know, who you've known for a long time, and you don't really have necessarily the kind of daily involvement in their life. Sometimes you get back with those people, and it's weird. Sometimes you get back with them, and 10 minutes later, it's like you're 20 again, and those are the people you end up sticking with. I mean, uh-huh. That's just my experience of adulthood anyway.
You know, I really think that the writing was true to the characters, and I was super happy about that whole reunion and the reunion with Bran. Like, it just worked for me. It really did. And I hope that it doesn't end too quickly, because I'm really curious about what Bran is going. Is Bran waiting for Jon to come back, or what?
Where's he going to go? Mira left. Hodor's dead. Where the hell's John go?
Bran go? Now, I don't know. Is the King Road paved yet? Can he? I mean, does he? All right. So in the book, right? Dude's in a tree.
Right.
Does Bran end up in a tree, or does show Bran stay outside of the tree and just stare at them?
Well, I kind of got the impression, I guess from the show, that the reason he was in the tree was because he was very old and his human physical body was giving out, you know, and was not going to, you know, he was reaching the end of what would be his natural lifespan. And so he kind of merged with the tree because the tree was going to live a lot longer. And so I would think that Bran would have, you know, at least a couple more years, 20, whatever. He's got a little while, right, before he has to meld with a tree, wouldn't you think?
Well, I mean, and your explanation is pretty good. I didn't even think about it like that. And, you know, I'm cool with that. I mean, it's a fantasy series, so, hey, I'll go with it. but seeing him outside, and I'm just like, okay, so he's just, like, out and about, huh? I don't know, I guess, does he, like, just live at Winterfell now? I mean, it's just, that's something I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around, that he would just live at Winterfell. I kind of feel like that's too small.
Well, I'm assuming that that's going to be part of, that he's basically going to have to kind of jack into the mainframe to be able to wrap this thing up. And he most likely won't be able to do that at, you know, in the Weirwood Forest, in the Hearts Forest. What do you call that? I'm sorry.
Godswood.
Thank you. The Godswood. I knew there was a really beautiful word for it, and I was fucking it up. In the Godswood at Winterfell. You know, if he's going to jack into the mainframe, right, he's probably going to have to go someplace that's a little more of a seat of power.
And in the South, there aren't a lot of those. So I guess,
right,
you know, he would either be there or north. And that's really the only place he can be. All right. I feel a little bit better about that now. All right. Thank you.
Well, and that may and that may be, too, you know, it may be that the, you know, the original three or the three-eyed raven that we know had to meld with the tree in order to be able to become less mortal. But Bran ends up having to meld with the tree in order to be able to end the long night, you know, and it's not necessarily a matter of his body being aged and giving out. It's a matter of that's what he's got to do to be able to be as powerful as possible. It just, to me, that seems like the most reasonable. It would be weird if at the end of this series, Bran is like sitting by the fire telling the story to the next generation of Winterfell or something, right?
Weird. So Mira.
Yeah.
Mira's gone. And I was a little upset, not upset last week, but I was kind of bummed that Mira didn't have any lines last week. So I'm glad we got to see her.
Ooh, did she get some lines this week?
Yeah. It was nice to hear her say, or to have someone kind of confront Bran and force him to acknowledge that this is weird, buddy. And like, people care about you and you're not showing them any, there's no emotion, there's no affect. Do you care? And when she said, what'd she say? You died in that cave. And he's just like, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, wow.
Yep. Hard to argue
that way. Yeah. Do you think we'll see any of the other reads? Wink, wink. We met him, right, at the Tower of Joy in the flashback, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I have been enjoying that whole idea, and I have really liked the idea of bringing Hallen into this thing finally, but then, you know, Mira has this really very powerful moment that frankly felt to me like a sign-off. You know, so I've liked that idea. I don't really know that it makes sense now. It felt a lot more like, how do we kind of prune this tree a little bit more? without killing Mira, for God's sakes, right? And she says, when winter comes, I want to be with my family, you know, and yeah. I've seen some people link that to the possibility that Helen is going to show up, but it just felt like too much of a closing moment, and frankly, it was really good, so too good of a closing moment. It's almost wasted if you bring her back, like, in, like, you know, Rambo tying the bandana around her forehead mode, right?
Well, I thought we had said goodbye to Jorah. I thought he had a great sign-off, and, you know, now...
Solid point.
So, you never know. We'll see.
Solid point. Yep.
And, I mean, Sansa seems to think that people are going to converge upon Winterfell, so I guess if we even get to that point in the story, you know, maybe that'll be why, if people just start moving north to go to the castle.
Right. It's entirely possible. It seemed to me just kind of more like a, you know, thing for Sansa to still be, like, knowing stuff. But, you know, it could also be a way to excuse virtually anybody popping up at the door, so...
Also at Winterfell, we get the sparring match between Brienne and Arya after Pod gets his behind kicked again.
Okay, I would actually really like to talk about Podrick in this. No, I'm joking.
I'm like, oh, the floor is yours, Mike. Please tell me.
I mean, come on, this was fantastic, right? Like, I don't know if you call it fan service. I don't know what you call it. I loved every minute of it. You too, I'm assuming?
Yeah, it was great for a few reasons. I mean, the fighting itself was great. The fact that, you know, these two women who have been told not to fight forever find each other again and can kind of, you know, be peers in a sense. It was just a nice moment. Like, they both felt, they looked invigorated. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, they're in the middle of a really good workout, or like when a runner is like hitting their stride. Like, it was awesome.
Also, like, Brienne doesn't seem to me like the type of person who would be put off by a challenge. You know, I mean, especially one that isn't actually going to end in her bleeding all over the floor, right? And when was the last time she was challenged in training? I mean, I think we got a pretty clear sense that that Pod hasn't gotten up to the point of challenging her yet, right? So it was a nice moment also, because I feel like Brianna is a person who would, like, take that in stride, you know, and almost be invigorated by it herself, and not just, like, go home and grouse and think about a way to, like, kill the kid while she's asleep, you know?
Yeah, I mean, once she got over the fact, I don't even want to say got over, but it's like she was probably really pulling her hits at first, and then she's like, holy crap, this girl's good. And then it's like, oh, is this what we're doing? You know, but it was all with respect, you know, it wasn't antagonistic at all.
It was cool, too, how they shot it, because the kick to the chest seemed like muscle memory. You know what I mean? Like, Brienne herself, if she would have even had a moment to think about that, would not have kicked this child in the... right? Like, this kid who's not wearing armor, for God's sakes, you know? It just seemed like muscle memory. It was so good. So good.
There was a shot in the beginning of the fight where it was from Brienne's perspective. So the camera's pointing down at Arya. And you see, like, this, not wild-eyed, but, like, this eager face. But it's still such a sweet face, you know? But it's trying to kick your ass, like.
Yeah, well, and they did a lot of POV work with the camera. I mean, not direct POV, but just in terms of angling. Because there's so much difference, you know, in the height of those two actors. And that was just, you know, that was really great. I mean, that was really great. They did, well... I'll talk about that in the final scene as well. The way they kind of did. I mean, I associate it with, you know, with Orson Welles, the low angle kind of like moving shot that they followed Bronn through the fight, you know, and they did. They very much kind of foreshadowed that or did a similar thing in the fight scene. And it really, really worked. It really worked, you know.
Super all right, well, you're the film guy, so I'll leave all that to you.
Well, I didn't say anything you didn't just say. Like, they put the camera low because that's, yeah.
Good angle, yes, good.
Well, it was really cool, too, how she, you know, she said you can't use that sword and, you know, I'll not cut you. It just, like, the attitude, and I didn't, really spectacular.
Yeah. It's good. It's nice to see Brienne happy.
Right? You know? Right? Taking a break, having a hot meal, right?
Yeah. Like, let's just let Brienne breathe for a moment.
Yeah. A hot meal that wasn't burned by Pod.
Poor Podrick. And then, you know what? You can almost see her hesitance, like when Podrick's trying to compliment her and let her take credit, at least a little bit of credit for the Stark kids, and she doesn't want to take it, and then it's just like, okay, you know, like, let me just sort of be happy in this moment.
Yep, really wonderful. And then we see Sansa getting fucking weird. What was going on with that? I don't know what to make out of that.
I saw some stuff on Twitter, you know, is Sansa afraid of Arya? And look, what do I know? But I'm just thinking maybe it's just fear of what she's become, but not fear of for her own safety. You know, like when my brother came home from the army, I was really little. And he's like telling me about like guns and like these bulletproof this. And I like, look, I'm from North Jersey, right? Like we don't do guns. Bad guys and police have guns, right? Like that's right. My life. So I'm just like, oh my God, you know, like guns. And he thinks they're amazing. He's telling me about like the things that you wear with the bullets on them, like for the automatic. And I was scared, right, of the stuff. But I wasn't scared of my brother. Like, I didn't think he would use a gun on me. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
But I remember being completely freaked out at him explaining, like, all his cool, like, camo stuff that he had now.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I saw some people say, you know, something similar about how, like, not only is she worried that she's on Arya's list, but that now Arya can beat up her bodyguard. Right, yeah. And so Arya's gonna kill Brienne and then Sansa, and I'm just like, get the fuck, that's crazy talk. That's not, there's been nothing in Arya, you know, her kills have been calculated. They've been ruthless, and she's been willing to kill whoever she had to get to the person she was trying to get to, right? But fuck the phrase. I don't care about, like, that doesn't make me worried about Arya's gonna kill Sansa and Brienne, come on. That to me was way too much.
Everyone she's killed has done something horrible. So I don't think that Sansa doesn't necessarily know that, but it just seems like a big leap to make.
Yeah, a little too much. I thought it was a weird reaction from Sansa's part, but I wasn't willing to read that much into it, so...
But, I mean, I guess if Sansa has been thinking deep down all along about Brienne the way Kat used to think about Brienne, and then she sees her sister acting the same exact way, she was probably like, oh.
Yep. That's a good point. Well, and, you know, the fact that Arya referenced Brienne beating the Hound, I really thought, I enjoyed that callback. I was glad to see that. You know,
and the Hound should still be heading north, right? With the
that's the idea.
Oh, wow, the gang, they might all be back together.
That's the idea. Can you imagine that scene with Arya and the Hound?
You got Arya and the Hound who have history, Brienne and the Hound who have history, Sansa and the Hound who have history. I'm gonna be like climbing the walls, like, I'm not even.
Yep.
Gonna be able to sit still.
Yep. It's good stuff. Good. All right. Anything else at Winterfell, or are we good on Winterfell?
I think we're okay. I think we can move on to Dragonstone.
Okay.
So I want to, I guess we can start off with what I thought was probably the weakest part of the episode for me. So I'm curious to see what you think. And it was the part where John shows Danny via the cave drawings. And it's not that I didn't like the cave drawings or anything. I just felt like the scene didn't quite work for me. I'm not really sure what was missing. I thought it was going to be cool at first. I was totally into drawings, and then it just felt a little too simple for me. A little too, like, one, two, three, four, connect them. Good. You know, like, it just felt like that to me. But, you know, how did you take the whole scene?
It's never really been clear to me if Emilia Clarke is a terrible actress or if they don't write her good dialogue. But, you know, that was one thing that came out on the, I think Susan said that on the fan call-in this week, that Kit Harington and Emilia Clarke are the two weakest actors on the show. And, you know, I think that's a fair assessment. And I think that that has something to do with it, you know, with what you're talking about. And I also think that they write them kind of me Tarzan you Jane dialogue, you know, counting on Tyrion and Davos and, you know, Tormund and the people around them to kind of bring the spice, you know, the dialogue spice, right? And I don't know if that's about the characters, if that's because the writers know something about the actors that we don't know, if that, I don't have any idea, but you know, it seems like they have fairly simplistic lines pretty often. And so then when you put the two of them together, right, these two people have pretty simplistic dialogue and you give them this big kind of reveal, and it's like resting on them. It's not really a recipe for success, I don't think, you know. So you put a lot of money into the pictures and hope people aren't really listening.
And, you know, I think Susan is probably definitely right about that, because at the – do you ever watch the where Benioff and Weiss talk at the end about the episode?
Sometimes. I did not this week.
So Benioff says – that there, this is the beginning of the attraction between the two of them. And he goes, it's not, he goes, it's not from any dialogue we wrote. It's from the two of them being in a small place together, and you just feel the attraction. And I'm looking at him like, I did not, like, I'm raising my hand like, I didn't catch that at all, sir. And maybe you need to write it, because these two, I don't know if it's lack of chemistry or like, or just not great at acting. Like, maybe, but see, I've seen Emilia Clarke in other things and I felt like she's pretty good. Kit Harington was in some melodramatic movie and I thought he was super sweet in it and like really loving. So I don't know what the problem is here.
That's what I mean about, you know, the possibility that it just comes down to a sense of how the writers feel about the characters. You know, and this idea that, that the characters aren't the flavorful dialogue, aren't where that comes from in the show. And so what do you do when they are the only people on screen to talk to each other? You just kind of have to suffer through it, I guess.
Because when she's talking to Missandei on their way down and she's like making that cute line about Grey Worm, like he has to come back, right?
Like, yeah, like I'm not getting any, like, tell me a story. Let me live vicariously for
Her eyes lit up like many things, right? Like that good was call. A cool conversation. Like, you know, like let the camera roll. Like I want to girl talk. Everybody sit down. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
You know? And all of it just like leaves her. And I don't know, maybe she's posturing, you know, partially that could have been the direction.
Bend
right?
the knee.
Like, you know, you know that you still need this guy to do it. So it doesn't matter if you think he's cute or whatever, like be tough.
Right. I thought that was a really fascinating little, like, injection of that part of the character that you talked about in the book last time, right? Where, you know, she's judging people on how cute they are and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was like a really like interesting way to inject that part of her character without undercutting all the maturity that we've seen her experience in the show that we haven't seen in the book. But as soon as that scene was up, I was like, look at Tracy, like making the call, you know?
And I mean, I guess what will really tell the tale is, you know, when somebody makes a move, right? Whatever it may be. And I mean, John, I don't know. I don't see John being like, he's that guy that every girl wants because he doesn't know how cute he is, you know, like that's the dream. So it takes a woman like Daenerys to recognize that and completely take advantage of it.
Nice. I like it.
That's what has to happen. Because, I mean, what did Davos say? I saw you staring at her good heart or whatever.
Yep.
So funny.
Yep. I thought that when they were walking out of the cave that they were, it looked like they were holding hands. We couldn't actually see their hands. The shot, you know, was basically kind of from the elbow up. But the way they were positioned and the way their arms fell and everything, I thought it kind of looked like they were walking out holding hands. Then when you go to the reverse and you actually see them come out of the cave, they're not holding hands. And so that may have just been kind of a subliminal reference or something. Or it may just be yet another thing that I just made up. But that was the way I took them walking out. So I kind of thought that was just a visual, you know, cue of the possibility that they're going to end up romantically involved, which I'm not into that idea at all.
I'm a little nervous. Did you hear the initial reaction? With you know, he seemed to pick up on something with his whole, you know, sitting in a tree, KISSING song.
Right.
You know, You don't break that out for no reason. So I guess you have to find out from Axel. Was he, you know, just being silly, or did he pick up on any heat there? Because, you know, some actors, they're on screen together and you're like, holy crap, man. Like,
yep.
You guys have something going on?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
But not these two.
No.
So then they come out on the beach. And, you know, I kind of thought that what we learned in the cave was more Danny learning things, not really us learning things. So, cool. Then they come out and they have a little conversation about how nothing's going right. And she says to Tyrion, you know, maybe you actually don't want to hurt your family, you know. And this was something interesting that, you know, last week everybody was like, Tyrion's getting everything wrong. And then sure enough, she called him out on it, which I thought was really neat to see. And then she goes to John, and this was an interesting thing too, because I saw some people, you know, basically kind of saying that she ignored everyone's advice, including John. And I didn't feel that way, because she did not burn a city. She went and fought an army. Right. So I actually thought she took his advice. And the difference being that, you know, presumably when you burn a city, you're burning a bunch of civilians along with, right? So I thought she took his advice. I thought that was pretty interesting.
I thought so too. I saw it the way you saw it. If you're a soldier, you're ready for a fight, and she brought the fight to the soldiers. I mean, there were no small folk, to use a Westerosi language, mm-hmm. right? No small folk around. So I agree. So this whole thing about Tyrion not being, you know, the one with all the answers, do you think that'll have any long-term effect, or especially if she's closer to John?
I think that Tyrion is about to get really personally wrapped up in busyness. I think Tyrion's about to have other things that he's thinking about besides just being like solely focused on Dany. I think we're about to pass out of that phase for Tyrion.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, not least of which is the fact that he's a good peace hand, perhaps, but not necessarily a good war hand.
Diplomacy seems to be his strength.
Right.
Back, not back plan.
Right. And diplomacy, you know, let's be honest, only works if it's backed up, you know, by the threat of violence, frankly. So, you know, but it doesn't necessarily seem like that's his strong suit. And now, you know, once we go to battle, I mean, this is the thing that I thought when we see Tyrion at the fight, because this is the last scene before we go to the fight, right? And then Theon shows up, but we're not really going to talk about that. are we? I mean, for Christ's sakes. Like, because, this is the one thing I will say about it. It kind of looked like Jon was a little bit in charge, which was weird. Because, like, if they didn't know Theon was on the boat, then why would Jon be the one who to kind of welcome them, right? It would make a lot more sense that she would leave Tyrion there and leave Tyrion in charge, you would think, unless she wanted Tyrion to go watch her burn that army of his family that she just accused him of not wanting to be hurt, right? I kind of took his presence there as a punishment almost.
I'm wondering if he was just there because he was, you know, okay, it's a Greyjoy boat. Like, I want to see if this is friend or foe. Like, I'm going to go down there. Not so much that he was placed in charge, but that he took it upon himself to go.
So, Missandei's running the joint? Like, who's... Is there no leader when Dany's gone? They're just like this great hippie commune?
It's, I guess, Missandei, and then whoever the top Dothraki are probably report to her.
Because all the Unsullied are gone. Okay, yeah. So you don't really necessarily need that much of a support structure. Besides, there's nobody there, so they're just walking around pulling cans of Spam out of the cabinet, and everybody's good, right?
Yeah, I think they really simplified this whole area, right? It is literally deserted, you know, before they got there, so they have no one else to worry about. There's one boat. People go to the shore, that's it.
So why do you think she took Tyrion?
You know, I wonder if she wanted to see how he would react. You know, like, okay, I'm fighting your family. You're coming? Okay, good. Let's go. Let's fight your family.
Yeah. It was a punishment or a test of some sort. Or, right?
Definitely so, a test.
Do we want to, because I kind of want to keep going with Tyrion and like, just, like, skip straight to, we shouldn't do that, right? We shouldn't just jump straight to the end.
I mean, what about, do you think there's anything to that conversation with Davos, Jon, and Missandei about bastards and...
You know what?
Because Missandei has this whole thing about why they followed Dany.
Oh, I think that actually there was one moment in there that I found instructive, but I don't know. This is just how I watch television. Whenever a character says that doesn't matter, I take that as the writer telling us to shut the fuck up about something they're tired of getting emails about. I usually take that very literally. And John, you know, when he was trying to figure out, you know, how to introduce him, he said, it doesn't matter. John looked straight at him and said, it doesn't matter. And then they have this conversation about how to Missandei, not only does it not matter, but like she had to be taught even that anybody thinks it matters and it still feels weird to her. So I took the conversation that happened after he literally says it doesn't matter as further confirmation of the fact that ultimately this is not going to be important. Which is going to be why? Because he's going to ultimately bend the knee or renounce. There's two options here. Either he's going to renounce, you know, once they figure out that he's a Targaryen, he's going to renounce his claim to the throne, or he's going to marry her, you know, and they're going to do it together. And to me, it just seems way more likely and interesting if he renounces the whole thing. And so, again, it's not a question of him bending the knee as the king of the North. It's the question of him saying, I don't want to have shit to do with any of this as a Targaryen.
renounce the whole thing.
Yeah, man. And don't you think?
Just a civilian, just Citizen John.
Yeah. What else is... I mean, I don't, like... I think that he will end up as basically the Lord of Winterfell, you know, or he's going to die. I mean, I don't, you know, what else, like, it just seems very hard for me to imagine him, you know, all of a sudden getting interested in, like, what's he going to be on the small council?
I don't know.
Right? This is, like, what a weird ending, you know.
Yeah. That's like the ending of last season of Fargo. Well, that's... Did you watch that?
No.
Okay. Anyway.
You're not making me want to now that you're saying
Basically, a cold-hearted killer ends up in a cubicle.
There you go. That just seems to me just like a very unreasonable end to this whole thing. It just seems to me much more because, and that's him renouncing all of that stuff is that final way of him saying, like, I didn't want this in the first place. You know, I'm not even taking the ball and going home. You can have the ball. I'm just going home, you know.
Okay.
No, is that like, is that crazy talk?
It's not crazy. It's not crazy, but I need to fill in some more blanks around that before I can
jump fair. With you.
All right. So we want to quickly mention that Theon arrives.
And still sucks.
From Daenerys to go rescue Yara from Euron, but Dany's not home. And Jon gets to kind of threaten Theon a little bit, or I don't know. Let him know.
Whatever the hell that was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess they had to address it somehow. But because it would be weird for it to not come up or to Jon to not have an opinion. So, I mean, the fact that they made it, you know, a sentence or two, I guess, is probably a fair, you know, fair choice.
It was an oddly constructed sentence, though. Because of what you did for Sansa, or what you did for Sansa is the only reason I'm not killing you right now. It's just an oddly constructed sentence. I was like, I feel like you have your sentiments, like, flipped there.
Yeah.
As far as the way English normally works. But anyway, whatever. Stupid Theon. Bleh.
Oh, right, and it was almost like, you know, okay, wait, where's Daenerys? And then we move.
Right,
and
right.
We go right from there. So the first time I watched this, I was a little confused because I thought the show, like, made a mistake. I didn't realize that they had moved and, like, a bunch of time had passed. Because I was, the last I remembered, you know, Bronn got sent off with, oh, wait, you know what? I'm going way too fast. We have to go all the way back to the beginning. Bronn wanting a castle.
Sure.
Bronn wants a castle. I didn't really think Bronn would ask for something like that. I don't know. What do you think?
It was fine. It made total sense. It's Bronn's been asking for that all along. Absolutely. I didn't think it was weird at all.
Okay. So I'll take that.
He has continuously said, like, I hear the Lannisters pay their debts. I've never seen it. Like, he's basically kind of had that. He's been saying that since season 3.
And then he gets sent off to assist the Tarly men with getting the locals to give up their harvest.
Flogging the farmers.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess. Sure. I mean, I guess it's sort of like, you know, spoils of war, right? Like, if they took the Reach, they get to pillage as they see fit. I guess it's sort of like the ugly side of all of this and how the small people suffer. Kind of like the underlying theme of the book series, for sure.
Yep. And he gets a big bag of gold, and Randall Tarly still sucks.
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of a nice way to open.
And so then, I mean, and that's pretty much just what the opening is. And then, you know, we see all these other scenes, and then we cut back. And this is where I was confused, because I'm like, wait a minute, Bronn's not, you know, they're not all together. I was completely confused. But what I'm guessing is they must be pretty close to King's Landing, right?
I don't know. I didn't think so, but maybe you're right.
Well, because for Randall to know that the gold made it into the gate, how, you know what I mean? Like, how does he know for sure?
This is an interesting thing. I did an interview this week. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to hear it yet, with Kelly DeVries, who's a doctor and a professor, and works at Loyola University, Maryland. And he is a historian, medieval historian. And he talks about, I mean, he does like weapons and weapons tech, right? But he also just does general medieval history. So he and I talked a lot about all kinds of cool stuff, you know, and things that are represented. We talked a lot about weapons and fighting styles, and it was a neat interview. It was a lot of fun to talk to him. And when I asked him at the end, you know, what weird little things that the rest of us don't recognize, have they either gotten right or wrong, right? Like, what's a thing that you would pick up on but the rest of us really wouldn't? And what he talked about was food. So I promise I'm going to get back around to your point. So he talked about how, you know, basically in the Middle Ages, everything was either forest or it was tilled land, that there wasn't really a lot of, you know, and that we've seen very little tilled land, and we've had very little conversation about food in this series, the television series, but that lately, in the last couple episodes, we've seen everybody talking about food. You know, winter is coming, right? We've got to store stuff, you know? And one of the things he brought up that was particular to this episode is that the reason why the wagon train was still there, the wagon train that we're looking at is still there, is because they're trying to load carts full of food, and carts full of food move slower than anything else, right? And if you played Oregon Trail when you were a kid, like I did. You know that wagons are notoriously flimsy, right? Like, you got to replace the wheels all the time and that kind of stuff. And in fact, we see Jamie riding by somebody changing a wagon wheel, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that we can't necessarily use that information that the gold has made it as a sign of where they are in space, and or even necessarily in time, because you would load the gold, you know, onto the fastest, most sturdy wagon you've got, and you would have, you know, Pony Express horses ready to go, so you could switch out horses, and you would basically have that moving 24 hours a day until it got to King's Landing, where you can't do that with grain because it takes up a lot more space. It's, you know, not necessarily heavier per ounce, but you're carrying ultimately a lot more of it. And so I think that it was actually realistic that the gold would have arrived long before the rest of the whole army, you know, which another thing to remember is that the gold is being carried by the fastest horses you've got. And historically, you know, 80% of your army or more is on foot. You know, you've got a cavalry that's mounted horse, but most of your people are on foot, and the army moves at the pace of the slowest person, right? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where it could take the rest of them much, much, much longer than it would take this one cart full of gold. So that is probably more of an answer than I needed to give. But that was the way I took it.
Could Randall be wrong?
It seems unlikely. I suppose it's possible, but it seemed more to me just like a way to keep everybody from being like, the dragon burned the gold.
All right. So, I mean, if we're assuming that everything's correct, then so the gold is gone. We've got all the guys sort of hanging out, and you know, we get the little comic relief moment, right? Of Dickon. And like, that laugh seemed so real and natural. Like, it was a good moment. Like, that, I feel like when they get comedy right, like, they really get it right. And that was a good, pure moment.
And Bronn helps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's amazing. That actor is so good. And Oh, and then we get this discussion, which a lot of people are saying reminds them of another callback with talking to Dickon about what it's like being in war and how it was horrible. And people are saying it reminds them of that conversation that Robert had with Selma about how first time he was at war and there was a Tarly boy.
Yep.
And he said, wait. That was such a great conversation. I missed season one. And then we get Bronn hearing the Dothraki in the distance. Did you realize what was happening before it happened?
I didn't realize that. I thought it was just going to be her and the dragon. It made perfect sense that she brought the Dothraki. But I initially thought we were just hearing the dragon, and I thought we were hearing all three of them. I want to back up for just 1 second. I found it really fascinating the way Dickon, even though he is physically the exact opposite of Sam, was not comfortable, is not full of bravado and machismo, is presumably not the son yet still that Randall Tarly wanted. Right? Like, he's out there, he looks good in his armor or whatever, but as soon as he starts talking, like, are you scared of that dude? I ain't scared of that dude. You know, right. I found that a really fascinating element of the character.
And the guy who played him last time kind of played him up. He was more smug than anything. Mm-hmm. So that could just totally have been an act.
Yep. So, anyway, I just found that a fascinating element of, like, further disappointment in Randall Tarly's life, which brings me joy. Okay, I thought it was just the dragons. Did you picture the Dothraki over the hill?
I thought it was just Dothraki. I was shocked at the dragon because I remembered when they were telling her, no dragon, it's too dangerous, da-da-da-da-da. So I thought, oh, well, there's the compromise. You know, right. Send a Dothraki. And because I could hear like the hoofbeats, and I'm like, okay. And again, makes total sense. And I think they were my favorite part of the whole battle over the dragon. I thought it was, I mean, I was cringing the entire time. I mean, every time like a horse got stabbed or fell or whatever, I'm like, But man, that was intense and it was amazing.
Yeah, there was a lot in this scene, and this was one I really wanted to talk to the military historian this week after this scene, right? Presumably there's going to be more battles, but there were so many little, just tiny, you know, war nerd, I don't know what else you call it, military geek. There were so many little tiny things, little details and stuff from military history wrapped up in this episode that were just mind-blowing. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got the dragon, which is not part of military history. But so it's kind of this fascinating thing because that's another like element of wargaming and stuff like that, right, is taking, you know, Alexander's army but giving him Napoleon's, you know, cannons or something, right? Like taking historical armies and messing with them, you know? And so in this scene, you got this, what really is a very traditional battle throughout, you know, thousands of years. There were organized forces from civilized societies, usually city states for most of it, but then eventually countries and empires and right. But you have these organized troops, and the way they fought for thousands of years was with shield walls. And there was a phalanx, which was, you know, more offensive and gave you a little bit more kind of motion and movement. But the shield wall was a common thing. And so you've got a wall of shields, and those shields eventually had spikes on the bottom. And so they would drive the spikes into the ground, which would even give that shield wall. And by wall, I mean each person is holding a shield, and those shields overlap. So there's no gaps, right? And they hold that wall. And then the people behind them, the guys behind them, they all have long spears. And so, like, you know, this is... one of these things from military history, and you know, Alexander used his father Philip's army, and one of the things that Philip did was he made the spears a lot longer, and he made them, you know, really sturdy, and so that was how they ended up beating the Persians. And like, I mean, this is, there's so much just dramatized, mythologized military history around this basic, you know, kind of format, right? And they, and you see it there, and it was really great the way they did it. It could be put, you know, it could be formed up quickly, and it was really effective. And one of the things that it was really effective against was barbarians, right? The historical word for it.
Right,
barbarians,
right,
on horses, right? And George has talked about how, you know, the Dothraki are, you know, kind of a combination of Native American traditions and Mongols, you know. And those, one thing that those two people both had in common was fighting on horses, and they fought much more as individuals than they did as a unit, as a group. You know, they could, they didn't have a shield wall, right? Everybody was out kind of fighting man to man. And we see that with the Romans and the barbarians from Germany, and you know, we've kind of got elements of that with the wildling, you know, the free folk in this show, and in, and then we have the Dothraki. But the thing that horses don't do is they don't just charge a wall, right? Like, that's one of the things, you know, they taught me in Boy Scouts when I was a little kid. If you play, you know, chicken with a horse, you're going to win, right? The horse is always going to go to the side, and horses don't do that. So there's this amazing thing where you've got all of these guys, and they're coming down on this shield wall, and there's this question of, you know, are they actually going to be able to do anything? Because the Dothraki, you know, you would assume are going to be really effective once they actually get into hand-to-hand combat against the Lannisters, right? But how do you break the wall? Well, a dragon helps.
Yeah.
And they showed that very clearly, where as the Dothraki are coming, she ends up leading, you know, ends up coming in the front. And this was actually a question that was on one of the, one of our patrons on Twitter this week asked, you know, why didn't she basically kind of hit the flanks and let the Dothraki just kind of bowl through the middle? Well, the reason is because the horses aren't going to break the line. But if you've got a dragon, and they show that basically from overhead, where the dragon comes through and pushes a big hole in the line, breaks a big hole in the line of shields, and then the Dothraki just break through that line. And you see all of the horses flooding into this center, this hole in the line. And at that point, you get through it, and, you know, the guys with, like, bow and arrows, like, what good is your bow and arrow at that point when a Dothraki is about to run you over with his horse? You know, so you effectively take out a large portion of the army, and everybody has to go to hand-to-hand combat, and then at that point, the Dothraki have a real advantage. So she can go and concentrate on burning the yeah, the train.
And you would imagine that they were just scared out of their minds, because they probably heard about the Dothraki screamers for years, yep, but never seen them.
And Phobos now, rules the battlefield.
The first time they see them, it's like happening now. So that's just like another level of fear. So it's like, holy crap, we're fighting. Like, we're in war right now. Okay, we're fighting. You know, your heart's going crazy. And then you realize who your opponent is. Right. And now you're like, oh, my God. And mm-hmm, then in the sky.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's another element. I mean, that's another one of those Greek things, you know, the Phobos rules the battlefield. The idea that, you know, most people who were killed in battle until World War One were killed after they, you know, there was some sort of like a break, basically. They were killed when they were trying to run away. And so as long as the shield wall holds, you know, and everybody kind of like stays in their form, everybody's, you know, got a chance, right? But the most likely way that that breaks in history is because somebody gets scared and starts to run. And as soon as you have a hole, even one, right, then it's a way for people to poke through. And so when you bring that dragon, and that's the point of all the yelling and shit, right, is to try, yeah, to scare her, you know, to try to scare them. Right. And I mean, you think about that, too, with the Lannisters, like they thought they were done fighting. Mm-hmm. Right. They went and killed like the 15 guys that were at the door, all guarding 100 bars of gold each. And they were like, mop this shit up. We're going home. You know? So there's that element, too, of a surprise attack. which they obviously pulled off. They surprised the viewers, let alone the Lannisters. I loved it, man. There were just so many little, you know, details like that. The way that the Dothraki were up on the horses, right?
Oh,
the way
God.
They were, like, standing up on it, right? Like, them dudes that, like, drive four-wheelers on the highway, but they're doing a wheelie and, like, dancing and shit. Like, so cool. There was that, you know, the way that the guy leaned all the way over on the horse and cut the leg of Bronze horse. You know, there is writing about Mongols being able to do stuff like that for 1,000 years or more, right? But there's no, we don't have examples of it now. The tradition was not kept up, you know? But that kind of stuff comes directly from reported history, and it's so amazing to see it, you know, at the pace of television instead of reading about it, you know?
Yeah. I'm actually kind of glad to hear that they're using actual tactics and actual, you know, like, they're just not throwing something up on the screen mm-hmm. because it looks cool.
Yep.
That there's a reason behind everything.
Yeah, we get into a lot more of that detail with the professor, and we also actually talk about the Battle of Cannae and the encirclement and the idea that a lot of people felt like the Battle of the Bastards was kind of based on that historical battle also. So we get into a lot more of those details with him. It's just a total history nerd session. It's great.
Well, I'm driving for 3 hours tomorrow, so you'll be keeping
perfect.
So did Danny have to burn that whole wagon train?
I mean, why not?
Why not? She was all upset that her Unsullied are going to starve because the Lannisters took all the food. Did she need to burn all that up?
I mean, we saw her, like, she torched, like, 4 or 5, you know, barrels, right? Like, I felt like what we saw was, I mean, for Christ's sakes, if that's the entire store for Westeros, they're screwed anyway. They better hope the Night King comes and kills them, because it's better than starving to death. it seemed like everybody kind of read that as her really, like, torching the entire harvest, and I just didn't really see it that way.
Well, I hope you're right, because if not, I was kind of wondering if she was maybe getting a little overexcited up there.
Right.
Some of the shots on the dragon, like, because Drogon is so big now, they don't need to get all of Drogon in the shot. Like, it doesn't make sense anymore. So if the camera's on her, they can kind of just, like, show his body moving mm-hmm. underneath her. And I feel like that works so much better than having, like, the wings and the head and everything in the shot, because then it looks fake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So just having the movement underneath her, I feel, just, like, makes the whole thing feel real.
Yep.
Or real as a girl riding a dragon breathing fire can get.
Dude, I was in it. Like, there wasn't a part of me that was like, that never happened. I was, you know, so I think it was pretty well done. You know, I was all the way there. So we see her come. Do you think Randall Tarley got cooked? That's been a big question, right? Like, a lot of people thought the guy pulling the helmet off.
Yeah, I thought that too. But then I realized that we haven't heard him mention the fact that his sword is missing once.
And that's weird.
I feel like that still needs to be said. I mean, unless yep. Dickon's going to say it.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
I was kind of wondering why they brought this actor in. So Randall leaving and him saying and doing more, maybe they're going to give that to Dickon, but I mean, my thought was, no, that wasn't him. That was just some Randall bald guy.
Right. Well,
I want to hear him go off about the sword. I want him to know about Sam somehow.
Right. Yeah, if that guy wasn't bald before that dragon cooked his head, he was certainly bald by the time he got that hat off. Oh, my God. That was another thing that I thought was really impressively well done about the episode. It looked like there was a lot of practical shots, a lot of actual fire. You know, obviously, the stuff coming out of the dragon's face isn't real, but it there was a lot of those shots that looked like it was actually dudes they set on fire, which I thought was really amazing. And I saw a behind-the-scenes photo this week that they actually dressed some of the camera guys up as Lannister soldiers, which I thought was really interesting. And I think that that actually has to do with, like I mentioned before, the kind of Orson Welles, like, touch of evil camera angle that you really saw, especially with Bronn. So after Jaime and Bronn are together, and Bronn, you know, Jaime says, you know, go get Qyburn's gun, right? And he's like, you know, and so then you see Bronn trying to go get the what do you call that thing?
The scorpion.
Scorpion, thank you. Again, see, like, Godswood, another great word. Like, you know, I don't want to just, like, call it the crossbow thing. It's a scorpion. So you see him, you know, trying to get to the scorpion, and he ends up knocked off of his horse, and he's running. And they've got all this low-angle touch of evil stuff where you're seeing him bump into guys on fire, you know, and the camera's just all over the place. And it feels very chaotic, and it just, there's so much more to it. It really adds a lot to it, you know, like if you imagine that. I mean, there's lots of different ways to shoot it, but to me, like, that was really a super cool choice. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you would put the cameraman in a Lannister outfit, right? Because, like, if he's moving the camera all over the place and he accidentally pans down and you see his Nikes, right? Like, that shot's not going to be in the show. You know, if he pans down and, you know, you've just got a moment of his boots or whatever, then it's one of those things that, like, we wouldn't even notice. You know, so I just, the whole thing, the practical effects, the way it just, it was really impressive, how they chose to do it, to not even talk about all the amazing story shit that happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you remember a couple weeks ago when I had asked the question, where is impulsive Jaime Lannister? Where did he go? Right? Where is brash Jaime Lannister that, you know, gets pissed off and just starts running?
Here he is. Well, and this was another thing that, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but this is another part of ancient military history that she, you know, we literally heard the words, I cut the head off the Dornish snake, the idea of cutting the head off the snake. And sometimes if you can kill the general of an army, you know, you can end the war right there, you know, and especially in a time when people believed that their rulers had a certain supernatural, or, you know, that they were gods on earth, right? Or in some way descended from or related to gods. You know, this idea that we talked about Joan of Arc, actually, in the interview with the professor as well, and the comparisons between Dany and Joan of Arc. And, you know, Joan of Arc just showed up out of nowhere. And as far as everybody knows, she had no military, you know, training or anything whatsoever. But she convinced all of these Catholics that you know, Jesus was on her side and was talking directly to her. And she was incredibly inspirational, right? And when they managed to kill her, it had a really deleterious effect on the army. And there's, you know, there's all of these famous stories of Alexander the Great, who would be fighting with his army, and people would be telling him that he should be standing in the back, and he didn't want to. And then he would be out there fighting with everybody, and he would spot, you know, Xerxes, or he would spot the guy, whoever was leading the army that he was fighting against, because there's multiple stories about Alexander where he did this. And he would just, him and, like, three dudes, his, like, best homies, would just charge into, right, just go straight into whatever threatening, dangerous, the middle of the army, because they would be going to try to cut the head off the snake, you know. And so in that moment with Jaime, that was what I saw, was a replay of those old stories of Alexander, where, you know, the way he would describe it is he would see the person, you know, and it's like somebody talking about being in the zone when they're playing sports and the basketball goal looks like it's, you know, 10 feet wide, right? Like, where you get this tunnel vision and the only thing you can see is this particular target. And he was riding into the fray despite the danger to go try to cut the head off the snake. And in this case, you know, she wasn't surrounded by Dothraki or, Persians, she had a dragon, which is probably worse.
Yeah,
it almost
didn't even
worked.
She didn't even look scared.
Nope.
Which I thought was kind of the best part.
He got pretty close, to be honest, you know? Like, I mean,
he did.
It almost worked, it looked like.
You know what?
Because think about that. Like, if he kills Danny, what happens? Like, what, Tyrion takes over? Fuck out of here. The whole thing is done if he kills Danny, right?
Who would die with her?
Exactly. Missandei doesn't step into her shoes.
No, they follow her. So if she's not around, they're free to go. Who's going to hold them?
It seems crazy, but it's actually pretty decent strategy. You know, even if Jaime dies along the way, you know, the Lannister cause, whatever, you know, doesn't fall apart because there's no Jaime, right? But Dany's whole thing falls apart without her.
And what do you think about Tyrion seeing him from afar and, like, kind of already knowing how his brother was going to react, right? He's like, don't you?
Yep. That was when it occurred to me that bringing him there was punishment. You know? That was at that moment that it really, I was like, oh, this is it. She brought him there so he could watch his brother die. But then he didn't. I do not think Jaime died. I do not think Bronn died. I do think it was Bronn that rescued Jaime, because you see Bronn looking at a horse with no rider, a white horse with no rider. And then the guy who saved Jaime jumped off a white horse to save Jaime. Right. So I think that it was Bronn and that they both survived. And now we are back to Prisoner Jaime. Prisoner Jaime is some good, good Jaime.
That's good,
right?
Jaime.
And then so now we have Prisoner Jaime. And not only do we have Prisoner Jaime, but we have Tyrion. We have the reunion of Tyrion and Jaime. And we also have the reunion of Tyrion and Bronn.
Yeah.
Let's not forget, but is also very exciting, the reunion of Tyrion and Bronn. And I don't see how the hell Tyrion talks her into letting either of these guys walk. I don't see how that's possible. And that's what I meant before about, I think Tyrion's about to get wrapped up in a whole lot of shit outside of her war plans, right? Is he going to let Jaime go? If he lets Jaime go, he better get the hell out himself. And then what? He's going to go hang out with Cersei? That doesn't make any sense. You know, so, I mean, what a pickle he's in now. That was,
the most
polite, old-fashioned way to describe the shitstorm. Not a pickle. He's in a shitstorm.
But, you know, Jaime let him out, right? I mean,
at no real cost to himself, though. That's the thing, is that Jaime didn't really have any, you know, consequences. Cersei was mad at him, but ultimately it didn't really threaten Jaime's position. But if Tyrion lets Jaime out, where's he going to go?
That would be the ultimate sacrifice for his brother.
I mean, do you really think she's going to forgive him? I don't think she would forgive him.
No.
God, we're going to end up in like an old folks home with Jon, Jorah, Tyrion. It's going to be all these cast out dudes.
One thing that was frustrating is that I felt like some of the situations that Bronn was in and he survived were like, it's okay that you want Bronn to live, right? But when you put him in a situation that seems like it would be completely impossible for anyone to survive, and he does, it's a little bit frustrating. And I think Donald was kind of complaining. That was something he was complaining about. Like, Bronn should have died. Jaime should have died. So, I mean, I'll be his voice. I'll bring that up. Because I did kind of think, like, oh, wow, we're going to lose Bronn in this one. Like, there's no way. And then he ends up, saving Jaime? And, like, Jaime's underwater with armor on. Do you remember the chapters in the book that would discuss the decision about wearing armor when you're on a ship, because you hit the water with armor on, you're pretty much done. So how is this show going to deal with Jaime? And also, I mean, they were right by the edge of the water, and then all of a sudden we're like in the abyss. all of a sudden. I don't know.
So it did seem a pretty steep drop off.
It was like a great shot and definitely reminded me of when Tyrion was by the Stone Men. It was, you know, that was a nice parallel, but
me, it reminded me more of, it's the reverse of the Bran shot.
Oh, wow.
Right? Of Bran falling out of the window is the reverse of that. If you look, because in the Bran shot, it's from the ground level, and you're looking at his back as he falls, right? But it's his whole body, and he's splayed out, you know, spread eagle, basically, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So this was the reverse of it. And that might be heavy lifting on my part, but that was what it reminded me of. All I have to say about Jamie and whether or not he lives or dies is his eyes were open. So.
Yes.
I.e. the Hound.
I think I need to give a little bit more respect to the Scorpion because I kind of poo-pooed it. Like, I was expecting something a little more, mind-blowing when Qyburn mm-hmm. said they were working on something, but seems pretty effective. I mean, that was what, Bronn's second, third shot, and he freaking, you know, did some damage.
It counted on the fact that the she was dumb enough to just fly the dragon at it. You know, if she would have, like, come from the side, I don't know. It seemed like there would have, I realized, like, it's got a ball bearing on it. He can spin it in any direction, but she did kind of, like, give him a soft target as far as that direction goes. And the other thing is, you know, if Qyburn would have poisoned the arrow, which I suppose we don't know that he didn't, right? But it seems to me like if you're going to go to all that trouble, you'd put a little something on there that might be more effective than just the barbs, right?
Yeah. Wow, you're pretty evil, Michael.
Everybody needs a Qyburn. So that, you know, yeah, I mean, it was pretty incredible, and I think those guys are going to come out of the water, and I mean, you know, if we want to sit here and pick apart frame by frame the fucking physics of it, you know, we can do that, but I'm not really into that. I think it was pretty awesome, and I can't wait to see Tyrion with a dripping wet Jaime.
Yeah. Right, and I wonder if we're going to see how he gets saved, or is it just going to be like, you know, oh, boy, that was close. We just sort of accept it and move on. So that'll be kind of interesting to see how they handle it. I don't know. But, yeah, Bronn and Tyrion reunited with these roles that they have now should be great. I mean, Bronn doesn't care what situation he is in. He's still Bronn no matter what. So that's great.
Yep. And the last time we saw them together was in the dungeon before Jaime let, right? Before the trial. Not even before Jaime let him out, but that was even before the trial when Tyrion asked Bronn to fight for him, and Bronn was like, sorry.
No. Yeah.
Isn't that the last time they were together?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, but I just, you know, and I really believe that Tyrion's, like, not going to hold a grudge or whatever, but I just don't see how Dany lets those guys walk. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see, she doesn't think she needs to trade them for anything, you know, so why not, right? Just, like, let the dragon eat them.
No.
I'm not saying that's what's going to happen to him. I'm just saying from Dany's perspective, like, I don't really see what argument Tyrion uses, right?
And John's there is at Dragonstone, so if they bring him back, I hope we find out where they are. I want to know how close they are to King's Landing.
Right, right.
Because that might determine where they go from there.
I mean, do you think there's a chance that they'll do that? That they'll go to King's Landing? Because she said, like, enough, like, what is it, tricky plans or whatever, right? Clever plans, you know? So if she killed the Lannister army, then presumably that frees up the Unsullied to leave Casterly Rock, right? I mean, because they were under siege, but if the Lannister army's gone now, then they're really only under siege from Euron's ships.
Right, water.
They will no longer be under siege from the land side, at least not something that they can't handle. So if that's the case, then she can reunite the Unsullied and the Dothraki. And if that's the case, then they can pretty much go to King's Landing and skip the clever tricks. And also, we've got 3 episodes left this season. And if we're going to stick to the whole thing that we talked about early on, about how basically this season is the war with men and next season is the war with the White Walkers, which I think it's, I mean, we haven't seen White Walkers this season yet, right?
No, so only Vision.
It seems like that is holding pretty much true. I mean, I guess they've got a couple episodes to whip it around, but it seems a lot more likely that episode 7 will be the episode 9 of this season, right, where we get the big war. And then in the final episode of the season, we're going to see, or episode 6 will be not what, right? So then in the final episode, we actually get a little more interaction with the Night King, probably via Bran.
Wow, 3 more episodes.
Dude, I know. Isn't that terrible?
Oh, man. All right. Well, I mean, this episode was awesome. I hope we get another. I'm feeling really good about this season. So I'm just like super happy right now. So I just can't wait for Sunday, honestly. Like, and I really, we need to see the Hound. So hopefully we'll see him. And maybe we'll check in with Jorah.
Yeah.
See if he's made any progress. Because Old Town's not that far from Dragonstone.
So there we go. And if he's going to go anywhere, you would think he would think to go there. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this was a great episode of Game of Thrones. Donald's attitude notwithstanding. And I'm looking forward to next week. And check out the interview we did with Professor Kelly DeVries. And check out the fan call-in. And Axel did a solo initial reaction. And Axel is a podcasting legend, so he can get away with that shit. Right?
Absolutely.
All right. It's been great to talk to you. Talk to you next week. And here's Axel to tell you how to get a hold of us.
Thank you for listening to Podcast Winterfell. You can find the podcast at dvrpodcast.com. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/dvr. You can email the podcast, podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at WinterfellPod and on Facebook, Podcast Winterfell.
Call recording has been completed.